For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the deaths of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war.
Ay me, I see the ruin of my house. The tiger now hath seized the gentle hind. Insulting tyranny begins to jut upon the innocent and aweless throne.
What is a man? Sure he made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused.
O my dear father, restoration hang thy medicine on my lips, and let this kiss repair those violent harms that my two sisters have in thy reverence made.
I am a king that find thee, and I know 'tis not the balm, the sceptre and the ball, the sword, the mace, the crown imperial, the throne he sits on, nor the pomp that beats on the high shore of the world.
This is the mighty history of the British Empire, a people living on a tiny island in the North Atlantic Ocean. Built an empire that circled the earth and brought freedom and education to languishing millions. This empire was blessed by Almighty God and one of his best educated teachers, William Shakespeare. Shakespeare has educated some of the greatest leaders of all time, such as Abraham Lincoln and Winston Churchill.
We shall never surrender.
Our troubled world needs a fresh crew of nation-building leaders. Are you ready to step up to the challenge? Welcome to the exciting classroom of Shakespeare's Royal Education with host Dennis Leap.
Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome back to Shakespeare's Royal Education. I have one comment today, and it's actually very nice, but it's also very short. And this is regarding our Royal Education program before, just right before this one. So we're in, obviously, in King John, and we talked about the Catholic Church and things like that. And this fellow, his name is Mr. Rich, Harold Rich, and he says, excellent discussion today, one of your best, thank you. So that's my comment. But I'll tell you what, it might be small, but it's a big one. And thank you. Thank you for writing in, and hopefully you're going to be writing in after today's program as well. Well, for today's program, again, the more I work with this play, the more I realize it has its difficulties, but it's also, once you understand it, it's just so much better. So for today's program, I want to go to Act 3, Scene 4. And this is right in line with what we're doing. And remember now, I said that Act 3 is probably one of the longest acts in this play. Not probably, it is the longest one of the play. But it's also, I think, it's the hardest one to understand. And so we're actually moving forward now. So we're if you remember, our last program we discussed Act 3, Scene 3, which includes the war between England and France. Now, King John's plot to have Hubert executed also shows up in that. And to me, that's probably one of the hardest things for me to accept about King John, that he would plot to have Hubert, who is the, remember, he was the fellow up on the wall at Angiers, and he wants him to execute his nephew, Arthur. Now, all of this takes place also with his mother, Eleanor, present at the time. And so to me, it's like, wow, here's his mother listening to her son plot the execution of her nephew. And so I haven't gone into the whole history, you know, behind the play to see if this is actually accurate. It could be just made up by Shakespeare, but I know there was trouble with Arthur. And anyway, Eleanor's present. Now, one thing I probably didn't discuss with you last time, but we need to just mention it right now, is that England won the war with France. And so it's this adds to the new dimension of the rest of the act. So England actually won the war. And essentially what John does is he plans his next move. He says to Hubert, you know, kill my nephew Arthur. I'm leaving my mother in France to rule the lands. So she's actually ruling now in Angiers. And he's going back to England, and because he wants to what? Secure the throne. He wants to make sure he stays on the throne. And so today, what I want to do is I want to move on to scene four. And again, you can go back and review the older series, you know, our last program. You can go back and listen to that again. I think it would be really helpful if you've forgotten some things. But it really is interesting now when we get into Act 3, Scene 4. So we're coming very close to the end of this of the play, by the way. And but essentially what you have here is you have King Philip of France. The Dauphin is there. Pandulf is there. And, of course, then Pandulf. And there are some attendants is there as well. Now, the attendants don't have much to say. But essentially, remember now, France lost the war that Pandulf started. And so here Pandulf is still sticking with the King of France, basically because King John took off for England. And so he's out of the picture for this part. But if we just start on page 68, line 1, King Philip says, "So by a roaring tempest of the flood, a whole armado of convicted sail is scattered and disjoined from fellowship." Now, essentially, what made King Philip lose the war was a tempest at sea. And I think it's really interesting. If you look at when Shakespeare wrote this book, he wrote it in 1623. The Spanish Armada, if you look at England's wars, the Spanish Armada, which was also destroyed by a tempest at sea, was in 1555. And so you can see that Shakespeare was obviously a historian, and he's adding that same influence into this play. And so I think it's really interesting, you know, what he's borrowing, what he's using. And so King Philip is actually pretty down and distressed that he lost the war. And remember, it was Pandulf that said, you know, "Hey, be a tough guy, fight for the church, fight for your mother, the church, for the Catholic Church, fight for your mother." And so, if you remember, people did not want Philip to do this, and he just went ahead and did it. And they had just united themselves; they had a pact between King John and Philip. They swore that they would protect each other, and he broke all that. And so Philip is now there still with Pandulf, and Philip he's not happy. And Pandulf says to him, he says, "Courage and comfort, all shall yet go well." And King Philip is really pretty irritated. He says, "What can go well when we have run so ill? Are we not beaten? Is not Angers lost? Is Arthur taken? Arthur taken prisoner?" And he's talking about, you know, the John's nephew. He says he's taken prisoner. "Divers dear friends slain, and bloody England into England gone." And when he says bloody England, he means John. He said bloody John is gone. He's gone back to England. He says overbearing interruption, spite of France. And so the thing is Philip is really down, and he's really, I think, beginning to realize he made a big mistake. He listened to the Catholic Church, or for the Pope's legate as well. So now his son, the Dauphin, or Louis, he tries to be positive. He says, "What has he won?" And he's talking about England. He's talking about King John. What has he won that he hath fortified? So how to speed with such advice dispose, such temperate order in so fierce a cause? Doth want example. Who hath read or heard of any kindred action like to this? And so what Lewis is saying is, look, Dad, he's gone. And look what he's doing. He wins. He dumps you. He's not worried about getting anything back together. He's just going to England. And, you know, where do we ever see anything like this? And King Philip says, well, could I bear that England had this praise so we could find some pattern of our shame? And so in some ways, I think Philip is really beginning to regret that he broke his tie with his brother, essentially. They're related. I mean, you have to understand that King John and Eleanor, they're all related. They're French. You know, they have some French in their blood. And then what we have is probably one of the most, significant female roles that Shakespeare had put into a play. And so enters Constance now. And again, we have to remember Constance is Arthur's mother, and she was married to King John's brother, older brother, Godfrey. And Godfrey, she was his wife. And then Arthur is Godfrey's son. And so her beef in this play is that her son, Arthur, should be ruling on the throne. He's only 10 years old. But it was Richard the Lionheart that appointed John as king. And so we've talked about this before. This is early England. They don't have, you know, all the rules set down as who's going to reign when a father dies. And it's now that's all written, that obviously it's going to pass to a son. And but here comes Constance. And what I want to do is just, maybe before we do this, if you have your book, I'm going to just recommend that you go to the front of your book, and you don't have to do it right now. But Shakespeare really created an interesting character here. And if you go to the front of your book, they give us a picture of one of the actresses from 1774 that acted this role of Constance. And it's really considered one of the most dramatic roles for a female, but it's also one of the most, fascinating and moving in the whole play. And it takes a really good actress to be able to play this role. But they give a picture of Anne Berry, and she was actually Mrs. Spranger Berry. And there's a picture of her as Constance in King John at Drury Lane. She first acted the part in 1774, and it became one of her great roles. She is shown at the moment of her exit at the end of Act 3, Scene 4, bewailing the death of her son. And we're going to be reading that today. So it is that we could, I guess, in a way think, oh, Constance, she's like such a dumb broad. What's wrong with her? You know, da 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 da. But actually, she really has a pivotal part in the play. So when we're still on Act 3, Scene 4, we're down to line, I think it's about 17. Constance comes in, and then Philip says, look, who comes here, a grave unto a soul, holding the eternal spirit against her will in the vile prison of afflicted breath. He says, I prithee, lady, go away with me. And so in some ways, what he's saying is she looks like death already. She looks like she wants to commit suicide. When it says there she's in the vile prison of afflicted breath, that's life. So her affliction is really showing. And then Philip wants to do something to help her. And then Constance, in some ways, she still has her head on her shoulders. And she said, if you go to the top of page, at 61, Constance then says, lo now see the issue of your peace. And so essentially what she does is she says, hey, Philip, don't you start instructing me. It's your fault that all this is happening because you listened to Pandulf. That's basically what she's saying. So she's going after him because Philip broke peace with John. That's what she's saying. You had already made a deal. You both had agreed to it. Pandulf shows up, and what did you do? You destroyed it. You destroyed the peace treaty. And then King Philip says, "Patience, good lady, comfort General Constance." And then Constance is not going to, she's going to speak her mind. She's not going to put up with it. She says, "No, I defy all counsel, all redress." She says, "There's no remedy now for what's happened because her son is gone. She doesn't know where her son is. Her son is taken." She says, "No, I defy all counsel, all redress, but that which ends all counsel, true redress, death, death, oh amiable, lovely death." So she's really, really depressed. She's saying, "The only thing that's going to make me happy right now is death." That's what she's saying. "Death, death, oh amiable, lovely death." And she goes on to say, "Thou odoriferous stench, sound rottenness, arise from the couch of lasting night. Thou hate and terror to prosperity, and I will kiss your detestable bones." So she's talking about death. And, you know, a skeleton usually represents death. So what she's saying there is, look, death, you show up, you're a skeleton, I'll kiss your bones. You know, in other words, she wants to die. She says, "And wring these fingers." This gets kind of gross, but, you know, this is Shakespeare. He can write gross things in a nice way, too. Or in a very poetic way. She says, "Thou art odoriferous stench, sound rottenness, arise forth from the couch of lasting night, thou hate and terror to prosperity, and I will kiss your detestable bones and put my eyeballs in thy vaulty brows and wring these fingers with household worms and stop this gap of breath with fulsome dust." So she's saying, she's going to dig out her own eyeballs. She's going to put worms on her fingers instead of rings. You know, it's just gross. It's really a gross view. And she says she's going to stop this gap of breath with fulsome dust. That sounds like the allergies we're all going through here. And he says, "And be a carrion monster like myself. Come, grin on me, and I will think thou smilest and bust thee as thy wife, misery's love, oh, come to me." Now that word bust there means kiss. She says, "I'll kiss you if you come after me, death." And then King Philip, he's just ready to vomit. He says, "Oh, fair affliction, peace." And, you know, it's hard for him to hear it, but he was guilty. He started the war. He let it all happen. And Constance says, "No, no, I will not. Having breath to cry, oh, that my tongue were in the thunder's mouth. Then with the passion I would shake the world and rouse from sleep that fell anatomy." And so what she's talking about is she wants to rouse that cruel skeleton from the grave, that symbol of death. She wants that to come up. She says, which cannot hear a lady's feeble voice, which scorns a modern invocation. Now, Pandolf is still there. If I were there, I'd want to slap Pandolf in the face, but I'm not there. But anyway, Pandolf was there. He says, "Later, lady, you utter madness and not sorrow." And so she's not happy with what he just said. She says, "Thou art not holy to belie me so." And so Constance not only takes on Philip, now she takes on Pandolf. And she says, "I am not mad. This hair I tear is mine." And if you go to the front of your book, her hair is really like everywhere, you know. And she says, "My name is Constance. I was Joffrey's wife. Young Arthur is my son, and he is lost. I am not mad. I would to God I were, for then 'tis like I should forget myself. Oh, if I could, what grief should I forget? Preach some philosophy to make me mad, and thou shalt be canonized cardinal." So that's really a dig. She says, "Okay, preach me some philosophy. Preach me some of your Catholic philosophy, and that'll make me mad." And she says, "And then you'll be canonized a cardinal." You know, so it really is pretty interesting how Shakespeare is kind of really picking on the Catholic Church with this play. But in some ways, he's exposing the truth. And I'm not, I don't want to diminish what he's done there, but he's, William Shakespeare was a Bible reader, and he knew Bible doctrine. And, you know, he knew all about Simon Magus in the book of Acts. He knows where Simon Magus's religion came from. It came from the Babylonian mystery religion. He knows all of that. And he says, then now through Constance, he says, yeah, preach me some philosophy to make me mad, and thou shalt be canonized a cardinal. For being not mad, but sensible of grief, my reasonable part produces reason, how I may be delivered of these woes, and teaches me to kill or hang myself. If I were mad, I should forget my son, or madly think a babe of clouts were he. Now, a babe of clouts is just a rag doll. And so Shakespeare uses this in other places as well, that a babe of clouts is just a rag doll. And she says, I am not mad. Too well I feel the different plague of each calamity. And so she's feeling everything that's happening. She's feeling it as it happens, and it's real. It's not made up, and she's not mad. It's just it's a lot of high stress and emotional feeling because, you know, she can't find her son, and she wants her son to have the throne. And she also, I'm sure, pretty much guesses that John is not giving up the throne to him. Then King Philip says, bind up those tresses, or bind up your hair. Oh, what love I note in their fair multitude of those her hairs. But where but by chance a silver drop hath fallen, even that drop 10,000 wiry friends do glue themselves in sociable grief, like true inseparable faithful loves, sticking together in calamity. And then Constance looks at it and says, to England, if you will. And then King Philip says again, bind up your hairs. So in other words, Constance says, go to England. Finish this war. What are you doing? And Philip tells her, bind up her hairs. And Constance says, yes, that I will. And wherefore will I do it? I tore them from their bonds and cried aloud, oh, that these hands could so redeem my son, as they have given these hairs their liberty. But now I envy at their liberty, and will again commit them to their bonds, because my poor child is a prisoner. And so there she rebinds her hair. Now, she's not done with Pandulf. She's going to go after him again. She binds her hair. In other words, she just puts it up, so it's just not hanging everywhere. And she says, and Father Cardinal, I have heard you say that we shall see and know our friends in heaven. If that be true, I shall see my boy again. For since the birth of Cain, the first male child, to him that did but yesterday suspire or breathe, there was not such a gracious creature born, but now will canker sorrow eat my bud. And so what she's thinking there, what she's saying, is I really think he's dead. He's been executed. And now the canker or a canker worm is going to eat my bud, or as a canker worm would eat a plant, now her son is going to be eaten by worms because he's dead. And so again, that's a little gross, but Shakespeare has a way of getting things across. It says, and chase the native beauty from his cheek, and he will look as hollow as a ghost, as dim and meager as an ague's fit. And, essentially what an ague is there is a fever. And so it's tremors that come from a fever. And he's either dead or he's sick. And so he'll die, and rising so again, when I shall meet him in the court of heaven, I shall not know him. Therefore, never, never must I behold my pretty Arthur more. So that is a very definite, I'd say, it's probably a Catholic belief. I don't remember being taught that so much as a Catholic. But I know that the Protestants do believe that everyone's going to see each other, you know, in heaven. And if you really study your Bible, families are going to be put back together, but there'll be a second resurrection, and everyone's going to be brought back to life on the earth, not in heaven. And that's right in your Bible. If you don't, I'm not trying to preach to you, but it's right there. There's going to be a second resurrection, and people are going to be brought back to life, and families will be put back together. All right, we don't know exactly all of that, let's say how all that's going to happen, but we know it is going to happen. It says, when I shall meet him in the, and what I mean by that is how families are going to get together. We know everyone's going to be resurrected, but how we'll meet each other, all that, that's not discussed in the Bible. It says, when I shall meet him in the court of heaven, I shall not know him. Therefore, never, never must I hold my pretty Arthur more. And so in other words, she's saying he's a young boy. She's getting older. Is he even going to know what she looks like? You know, that kind of thing. And Pandulf, then, he has to pipe up. He says, you hold to heinous a respect of grief. And then... You're going to think, okay, he's a celibate priest. He doesn't know much about women, you know. So Constance says, he talks to me that never had a son. And then King Philip says, you are as fond of grief as of your child. And then Constance says, grief fills the room of my absent child. And so we probably read some of that before, but I think it's okay now to put it in its right context. So if we just slip over now to page 64, she's not done. And you can see where this was a pretty defining role for a woman. She's challenging men, you know, on Shakespeare's stage, and one's a priest and one's a king, you know, so she's toughy. She goes on to say, grief fills the room above my absent child, lies in his bed, walks up and down with me, puts on his pretty looks, repeats his words, remembers me of all his gracious parts, stuffs out of his vacant garments with his form. Then I have reason to be fond of grief. Fare you well. Had you such a loss as I could give better comfort than you do. She unbinds her hair. And so she's saying that, you know, they told her, bind your hair. She's saying, I'm unbinding it. She knows she's not mad. She's very emotionally disturbed. She says, I will not keep this form upon my head when there is such disorder in my wit. Oh, Lord, my boy, my Arthur, my fair son, my life, my joy, my food, my all the world, my widow comfort and my sorrow's cure. And then King Philip says, I fear some outage and I'll follow her. So essentially what happens is Constance leaves the scene. Philip also leaves the scene. And the only one left in the scene, there's two actors left. It's Louis the Dauphin and Pandulf. So now you're going to have this conversation between Louis and Pandulf. And then the Dauphin... then that's Louis, is the Dauphin. He says, there's nothing in this world can make me joy. Life is as tedious as twice told tale, vexing the dull ear of a drowsy man, and bitter shame has spoiled the sweet world taste, sweet words taste, that it yields not but shame and bitterness. And then Pandulf comes up and he says, before the curing of a strong disease, even in the instant of repair and health, the fit is strongest. And so he's saying, well, look, come on, Louis, don't be so depressed. All these things that have happened, it's like, this is what happens before you cure a strong disease. Usually right before you cure a strong disease, it all fights back, you know. And he says, even in the instant of repair and health, the fit is the strongest. Evils that take leave on their departure most of all show evil. And what have you lost by losing of this day? And then Louis says, well, he's going to answer that. All days of glory, joy, and happiness. That's what I lost. Remember now with Louis and Blanche, a lot of this happened on near their wedding day. And took a lot of joy out of the wedding. We just had a huge wedding here at headquarters over the weekend, and it was 400 people at the wedding, and everybody was rejoiceful and joyful. It was a great day. No one wanted to see it end. And I feel bad for the families that had to pay for all that, but we sure enjoyed it. Louis goes on to say, he's lost all days of glory, joy, and happiness. And Pandolf said, if you had won it, certainly you had. No, no, what fortune means to men most good. She looks upon them with a threatening eye. 'Tis strange to think how much King John had lost in this which he accounts so clearly won. Are not you grieved that Arthur is his prisoner? And so he's saying, look, Philip, it's strange to think about what King John has lost. But maybe you need to start thinking about, maybe John didn't win so much after all, you know. And he says, are you grieved that Arthur is his prisoner? And Lewis says, as heartily as he is glad he hath him. And Pandolf says, your mind is all as youthful as your blood. Now hear me speak with a prophetic spirit. So Pandolf is saying, well, I'm a prophet now. So not only is the Pope's legate, he's also now a prophet. He says, for even the breath of what I mean to speak shall blow each dust and each straw, each little rub, out of the path which shall directly lead thy foot to England's throne. And so what he's saying to Louis or the Dauphin, he said, look, you need to think this through because there's a path for you to take England's throne. And so this is really, I think it's really very intelligent of Shakespeare, the way he wrote this. And you could just see that, why does Pandolf want him to have the throne of England? Because they can control England. Right now, if you look at it, remember that the Catholic Church started this war to get control of both England and France. But now that England has won, they've actually lost control of England because King John, actually, when he left the scene here, he went back and had himself, anointed him king again. And in their anointing, they said he was not subjected to the king or to the Pope in Rome. And so that's what he did. He hurried back. He met Pandolf. He knew Philip lost, and they still want, you know, Arthur to take over. And he goes back and gets himself, re-kinged or anointed king. So he's saying, look, you may have a path that leads directly to the throne. And therefore, mark, John has seized Arthur, and it cannot be that while warm life plays in that infant's veins, the misplaced John should entertain an hour. 1 minute, nay, one quiet breath of rest, a scepter snatched with an unruly hand must be as boisterously maintained as gained. And he that stands upon a slippery place makes nice of no vile hold to stay him up. That John may stand, then Arthur needs must fall. So be it, for it cannot be but so. So he's saying is, you know, John has Arthur. I don't think Pandolf knows that he's gone back and been re-anointed as king, and he does not have to obey the Catholic Church. But John is going to be nervous as long as Arthur is alive. That's what he's saying. It's going to be a thorn in his side. And he said, look, Lewis, Arthur is never going to take the throne, but you have the chance. That's what he's telling him. He's not worried about Arthur. He's not trying to get Lewis to love Arthur. He's trying to say, look, Arthur's going to fall. John can't keep the throne if Arthur doesn't fall. And so then you have access to the throne. And Pandolf says, so be it, for it cannot but be so. And then Lewis comes back. He says, but what shall I gain by young Arthur's fall? So in other words, he's not really getting what Pandolf's saying. He says, you, in the right of Lady Blanche, your wife, may then make all the claim that Arthur did. And so Pandolf is really, you know, he's probably thinking, wow, Lewis, are you thick as a brick? You know, don't you understand what I'm telling you? You married into the family. You married Blanche. And he says, you can make the same claim Arthur did. And then Lewis says, and lose it, life and all, as Arthur did. So he's saying, hey, I may not want that. You know, he said, what if I go do that and then they execute me anyway? Now, Pandolf is Shakespeare is really developing his character here. And it shows how conniving he is to get his way so they can get the archbishop, you know, on the throne in England. Pandolf says, how green you are and fresh in this old world. John lays you plots, the times conspire with you. For he that steeps his safety in true blood shall find but bloody safety in untrue. This act so evilly born shall cool the hearts of all his people and freeze up their zeal, that none so small advantage shall step forth to check his reign, but they will cherish it. No natural exhalation in the sky, no scope of nature, no distempered day, no common wind, no custom event, but they will pluck away his natural cause and call them meteors, prodigies, and signs, abortives, presages, and tongues of heaven, plainly denouncing vengeance upon John. And so Pandolf says, look, this is going to happen. They're all going to turn on John, especially when he executes Arthur. They're going to turn on him, and they're going to kick him out. And then Lewis says, maybe he will not touch young Arthur's life, but hold himself safe in his imprisonment. Pandolf says, oh, sir, when he shall hear of your approach, if that young Arthur be not gone already, even at the news he dies, and then the hearts of all his people shall revolt from him, and kiss the lips of unacquainted change, and pick strong matter of revolt and wrath out of the bloody fingers ends of John. Methinks I see this hurly all on foot, and oh, what better matter breeds for you than I have named. The bastard Falconbridge is now in England, ransacking the church, offending charity. If but a dozen French were there in arms, they would be as a call to train 10,000 English to their side. Or as a little snow tumbled about, anon becomes a mountain. O noble Dauphin, go with me to the king. 'Tis wonderful what may be wrought out of their discontent, now that their souls are topful of offense. For England go, and I will wet on the king. So Lewis says, strong reasons make strange actions. Let us go. If you say aye, the king will not say no. And so then they exit the scene. All right, now we're going to move into Act 4. We have time today. And this is the scene that I think it's a little gross for me. It's something that I'm kind of surprised about King John. And again, I haven't done a lot of history reading about King John. But I guess we have to accept the fact that even in the Bible, they were wanting to execute the next in line. They were one little guy. It was ready for the throne. They had to hide him because people wanted to execute him. So this is kind of like the way of royalty in the evil world that we do live in. So again, Act 4, Scene 1, this is enter Hubert and the executioners. So this is what Hubert promised he'd do. He said, I'll kill him. I'll execute him. And Hubert says, hear me with these irons hot, and look thou stand within the arras. When I strike my foot upon the bosom of the ground, rush forth and bind a boy, which you shall find with me, fast to the chair. Be heedful hence and watch. And so the first executioner then says, I hope your warrant will bear out the deed. And then Hubert says, uncleanly scruples fear not you. Look to it. So the executioners exit. And he said, young lad, come forth. I have to stay with you. And so Arthur was not present when the executioners came in, but he's now calling him to talk to him. This is Hubert. Arthur says, good afternoon, Hubert. And Hubert says, good morning. Good morrow, little prince. And Arthur says, as little prince, having so great a title to be more prince as may be, you are sad. And Hubert says, indeed, I have been merrier. And Arthur says, "Mercy on me. Methinks nobody should be sad but I. Yet I remember when I was in France, young gentleman to be as sad as night, only for wantonness. By my Christendom, so I were out of prison and kept sheep, I should be as merry as the day is long. And so I would be here, but that I doubt my uncle practices more harm to me. He's afraid of me, and I of him. Is it my fault that I was Joffrey's son? No, indeed it's not. And I would to God I were your son, so you would love me, Hubert." So now you have to start thinking, what is this doing to Hubert's heartstrings? He's getting ready to pop the kid's eyes out. And Hubert says aside, and this is just to the audience now, he says, "If I talk to him with his innocent prate, he will awake my mercy which lies dead. Therefore I will be sudden and dispatch." Then Arthur, this is really, really pretty good. And you wonder if Shakespeare wrote this thinking that Arthur or any other kid would figure it out before before the adult would figure out he knows what's going on. Arthur says, "Are you sick, Hubert? You look pale today. In sooth, I would you were a little sick, that I might sit all night and watch with you. I warrant I love you more than you do me." He said, "Oh, I kind of wish you were sick because I'd stay awake and take care of you." So that's really laying it on pretty thick. Hubert says aside, again, says to the audience, "His words do take possession of my bosom. Read here, young Arthur." He shows a paper aside, and he says, "How now, foolish room? Turning dispiteous torture of the door, I must be brief, lest resolution drop. Out at mine eyes and tender womanish tears. Can you read it? Is it not fair writ?" And Arthur says, "Too fairly, Hubert, for so foul effect. Must you with hot irons burn out both mine eyes?" So this is the instructions that Hubert was supposed to have to execute Arthur. And Arthur, he lets Arthur read it. He says, "Can you read this?" He says, "Yeah, I can read it. Must you burn out both my eyes?" And Hubert says, "Young boy, I must." And Arthur says, "And will you?" And Hubert says, "And I will." And Arthur says, "Have you the heart? When your head did but ache, I knit my handkerchief about your brows." And he said, "Look, they must have known each other." He says, "When you were sick, I put cold water on your head." He said, "The best I had," he's talking about a handkerchief, "the best I had, a princess wrought at me, or embroidered it." So a princess embroidered this handkerchief for him. And he says, "I did never ask if you again, and with my hand at midnight held your head, and like the watchful minutes to the hour, still and anon cheered up thy heavy time." So he's reminding Arthur, "Look what I've done for you." And he goes on to say, saying, "What lack you? And where lies your grief? And or what good love may I perform for you? Many a poor man's son would have lain still and never have spoke a loving word to you, but at your sick service had a prince. Now, you may think my love was crafty love and call it cunning. Do you, and if you will, if heaven be pleased that you must use me ill, why then you must. Will you put out mine eyes, these eyes that never did nor never shall so much as frown on you?" Then Hubert, he's getting upset now. He says, "I have sworn to do it, and with hot irons must I burn them out." And so that's just kind of chilling. Arthur then says, "Ah, none but in this iron age would do it. The iron of itself, though heat red hot, approaching near these eyes, would drink my tears and quench this fiery indignation. Even in the matter of my innocence, nay, after that, consume away in rust, but for containing fire to harm mine eye, are you more stubborn hard than hammered iron? And if an angel should have come to me and told me Hubert should put out mine eyes, I would not have believed him. No tongue but Hubert's. And then Hubert stamps on the ground, and he yells, "Come forth," and enter the executioners with the cord and irons, etc. "Do as I bid you." And Arthur then says, "Oh, save me, Hubert, save me. My eyes are out, even with the fierce looks of these bloody men." Hubert goes on to say, "Give me the iron, I say, and bind him here." "Alas," this is Arthur says, "alas, what need you be so boisterous rough? I will not struggle. I will stand stone still. For heaven's sake, Hubert, let me not be bound. Nay, hear me, Hubert, drive these men away, and I will sit as quiet as a lamb. I will not stir, nor wince, nor speak a word, nor look upon the iron angrily. Thrust but these men away, and I'll forgive you whatever torment you do put me to." So Arthur is saying, "Look, Hubert, don't let these strangers put my eyes out. You put my eyes out. If you put them out, I can handle it. But they're scary." And Hubert says, "Go, stand within, let me alone with him." And so he sends out the executioner. The first executioner says, "I am best pleased to be from such a deed." And so even the executioner says, "Well, I am so glad I'm not doing this." Then Arthur says, "Alas, I then have chid away my friend. He hath a stern look, but a gentle heart. Let him come back, that his compassion may give life to yours." And then Hubert says, "Come, boy, prepare yourself." And then Arthur is there no remedy? "None but to lose your eyes." And he says, Arthur then says, "Oh, heaven, that there were but a more, that were but a more in yours, a grain, a dust, a gnat, a wandering hair, any annoyance in that precious sense. Then feeling what small things are boisterous there, your vile intent must needs seem horrible." So Arthur's saying, "Yeah, it's too bad you didn't get a gnat in your eye. Too bad you didn't get, you know, a hair in your eye. Then you know what it's going to feel like when you put my eyes out. It's going to be a lot worse than that." And then Hubert says, "Is this your promise? Go to, hold your tongue." And then Arthur then says, "Hubert, the utterance of a brace of tongues must needs want pleading for a pair of eyes. Let me not hold my tongue. Let me not, Hubert. Oh, Hubert, if you will, cut out my tongue so I may keep mine eyes. Oh, spare mine eyes, though to no use, but still to look on you. Lo, by my troth, the instrument is cold and would not harm me." Then Hubert says, "I can hear it, boy." Arthur then says, "No, in good sooth, the fire is dead with grief, being create for comfort, so to be used in undeserved extremes. See, else yourself, there's no malice in this burning coal. The breath of heaven hath blown its spirit out and strewed repentant ashes on his head." And then Hubert says, "But with my breath, I can't revive it, boy." Arthur says, "And if you do, you will but make it blush and glow with shame of your proceedings. Hubert, nay, it perchance will sparkle in your eyes, and like a dog that is compelled to fight, snatch at his master that doth tear him on. All things that you should use to do me wrong, deny their office, only you do lack that mercy which fierce fire and iron extends, creatures of note for mercy lacking uses." And then Hubert says, "Well, see to live, I will not touch thine eye, for all the treasure that thine uncle owns. Yet I am sworn, and I did purpose, boy, with the same very iron to burn them out." And Arthur says, "Oh, now you look like Hubert. All this while you were disguised." Hubert says, "Peace, no more ado. Your uncle must not know, but you are dead. I'll fill these dogged spies with false reports. And pretty child, sleep doubtless and secure, that Hubert for the wealth of all the world will not offend thee." And then Arthur says, "Oh, heaven, thank you, Hubert." And then Hubert says, "Silence, no more. Go closely with me. Much danger do I undergo for thee." And so essentially what's going on then is Arthur's a really cool little kid. He got what he wanted. He got Hubert to back off, and he wasn't going to put his eyes out. And he knew that he could get in to touch Hubert's heart. And so I don't see how any human being could put a hot poker in someone's eye to take it out. But we know that has happened in the past. And so we just have a few more minutes today. I didn't plan on necessarily continuing at this point. I didn't know. It's really hard to predict how much reading you do and how much time it's going to take. But now we're in Act 4, Scene 2, and essentially what we have is King John enters, Pembroke, Salisbury, and other lords. So, in other words, King John is back at the English court, and he's got the leading man right there around him. And if you go back to the front of your book, you can, I think I talked to you about that when we very first began. You can find out who the Earl of Pembroke is, the Earl of Essex, the Earl of Salisbury, and these are all just supporters to the king. But King John says, "Here once again we sit, once again crowned, and looked upon, I hope, with cheerful eyes." So John is saying, you've re-anointed me, I'm crowned king, the Pope can't get to me, I'm not listening to the Pope. And then Pembroke says this, "Once again, but that your highness pleased, was once superfluous. You were crowned before, and that high royalty was never plucked off. The faiths of men never stained with revolt. Fresh expectation troubled not the land with any longed for change or better state." So in some ways, what these guys are telling him, you already were crowned. We did it again, but you were already crowned anyway. He says, "Therefore, to be possessed with double pomp, to guard a title that was rich before, to gild refined gold, to paint the lily, to throw a perfume on the violet, to smooth the ice or add another hue unto the rainbow or with taper light, to seek the beauties eye of heaven to garnish, is wasteful and ridiculous excess." So I guess these guys aren't that happy. It says, but Pembroke says, "But that your royal pleasure must be done. This act is an ancient tale new told, and in the last repenting troublesome being urged at time unseasonable." So I'm just wondering. No, I was correct. Here's a note at the bottom of page 73. It says, "The English court, once again, John has just had himself recrowned to mark the end of his domination by the Church of Rome. And so they're still, I think they're still upset that they had to do it, but they did it for him. And so let's go down to Salisbury now. He says, "To this effect, before you were new crowned, we breathed our counsel, but it pleased your highness to overbear it, and we are all well pleased, since all and every part of what we would doth make a stand at what your highness will." So King John says, "Some reasons of this double coronation I possess with you, and think them strong, and more strong than when lesser is my fear, I shall endue you with. Meantime, but ask, what would you have reformed that is not well? And well shall you perceive how willingly I will both hear and grant your request." So John is saying, look, let's get back on the straight line. What do you want me to be doing? Show me the way. Then Pembroke says, "Then as one that am the tongue of these, to sound the purpose of all their hearts, both for myself and them, but chief of all, your safety, for which myself and them bend their best studies, heartily request the enfranchisement of Arthur, whose restraint doth more the murmuring lips of discontent to break into this dangerous argument. If what in rest you have in right you hold, why then your fears, which as they say attend the steps of wrong, should move you to mew up your tender kinsman and to choke his days with barbarous ignorance to deny his youth the rich advantage of good exercise. That the time's enemies may not have this to gracious occasions, let it be our suit that you have bid us ask his liberty, for which our goods we do no further ask than whereupon our weal upon your depending counts it, you will he have his liberty." Now, guess who comes in? Hubert. So essentially what the leaders say, look, let Arthur out. You know, let him out of the prison. Don't hold him back. King John said, let it be so. I do commit his youth to your direction. Hubert, what news with you? And then John takes him apart. Pembroke then goes on to say, this is the man should do the bloody deed. He showed his warrant to a friend of mine. The image of a wicked, heinous fault lives in his eye. That close aspect of his does show the mood of much troubled breast, and I do fearfully believe 'tis done. What we so feared, he had a charge to do. So Salisbury comes in, the color of the king doth come and go between his purpose and his conscience. Like heralds twixt two dreadful battles set, his passion is so ripe, needs must break. Pembroke then says, when it breaks, I fear will issue thence the foul corruption of a sweet child's death. King John, we cannot hold mortality's strong hand, good lords. Although my will to give is living, the suit which we demand, which you demand is gone and dead. He tells us Arthur is deceased tonight. Indeed, we fear his sickness was past cure. Indeed, we heard now his death he was. Before the child himself, he was sick. This must be answered here or hence. So remember now what had just happened between Hubert and Arthur is Hubert was going to say he was dead, but he's not dead. Arthur is not dead. They're hiding him. And remember, Hubert said to Arthur, just pretend, we're going to pretend you're dead, and that's going to save your life. And Salisbury says, it's apparent foul play, and it's a shame that greatness should so grossly offer it. So thrive it in your game, and so farewell. And then Pembroke says, stay yet, Lord Salisbury, I'll go with thee, and find the inheritance of this poor child, his little kingdom of a forced grave, that blood which owned the breadth of this sile. 3 foot of it doth hold, bad world the while. This must not be born, this will break out to all our sorrows, and ere long I doubt. And so they all exit. And then John, King John is by himself and says, they burn in indignation, I repent. Then a messenger enters and says, there is no sure foundation set on blood, no certain life achieved by others' death. A fearful eye thou hast, where is that blood that I have seen inhabit in all those cheeks? So foul a sky clears not without a storm. Pour down thy weather, how goes all in France? And so that is going to be all the time we have for today. So on our next program, we're going to continue with now Act 4, Scene 2. And we're coming, like I said, we're coming close to the end of this play. And by the next program, I'll be telling you what we're going to do next. So please write me any comments you have to comments at kpcg.fm. You can also comment at my Twitter page, Shakespeare's Royal Education. And remember, you can find a good used copy of King John at ABA Books. And I know I found several copies for under $5. So thanks for joining me next time as we advance our royal education.
You've been listening to Shakespeare's Royal Education on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.